Hello, and you're very welcome to this, the very first edition of the Inside Politics podcast of 2021 from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. With me today are political editor Pat Leahy, our health editor Paul Cullen, and I'm delighted to welcome back political analyst and statistician Kevin Cunningham. You're all very welcome, although, Paul, not a very happy new year.
No, it's Groundhog Day. And earlier in the year when snow was on the mountains and there is no sight of a lift from lockdown until the end of January, as we all know. It's been an astonishing change of events, really, Hugh. We were best in Europe 3 weeks ago. We're worst in Europe in terms of the rate at which the virus is spreading here today. The reasons for that are still being debated. There is the added element of this new UK variant and the extent to which that may have played a role. But certainly front and centre in what happened was mixing and congregating and socialising before and during Christmas. It started in pre-Christmas socialising and it was sealed then by families uniting over Christmas. And that's families with people of all ages. And that's contributed to the rise in hospitalisations and ICU admissions that we've seen, because obviously they are usually older people. And there are probably people who picked up the virus around the Christmas table.
Now, graphic presentations don't work very well on podcasts, but I have been looking at a lot of graphs over the last 24, 48 hours. And they, you know, a lot of them tell a very, very startling story where the line representing Irish infections, which was kind of moseying along through most of November and December, quite good by comparison with most of our European neighbours, just takes off like a rocket in the last 2 weeks of December. And it now surpasses most of them. How accurate is that? To what extent are some of those numbers maybe skewed a bit by the fact that we had this backlog of tests which didn't come through the system? I mean, is it quite as bad as those graphs I was looking at are telling me?
Well, there is an ongoing debate about the kind of testing that we use. And I certainly, in considering a particular situation at a time, would be more interested in the number of people who are in hospital and in ICU. And as I mentioned, they are rising pretty sharply. The numbers in hospitals are set to exceed the peak that we saw last March or April around now. And the numbers in ICU have been moving upwards, but though not at the same rate. So there are a lot of, obviously, people who pick up this disease and it's not a serious experience for them, but it doesn't mean that they can't pass it on to other people. So I think that's the first thing you'd have to say there. But basically, I think we are at a stage where, you know, we didn't get low enough in our figures at the start of December, and we didn't know where the cases that we still had were. And then you have Christmas and season, you know, winter weather and indoor living and so on. And you throw that into the mix and possibly this new variant. And when you throw all that into the mix, it's like, you know, setting something on fire, tinder, and it just erupted. That's not to say that we won't come down off this peak pretty sharply, because one thing we have been able to do, and this is the third or fourth time we're doing it now, is to put in place a lockdown pretty early and be pretty successful in stopping a surge.
And this lockdown, we understand, we're waiting on further announcements later today, but we have a pretty clear idea of what's coming down the line. This will be the strictest one since the measures introduced last March.
Yeah, I mean, maybe there might be 5 kilometre travel instead of 2 kilometre or something. There may be some more shops open, hardware might stay open or whatever, but it's pretty strict. And it's also, I think it's also in terms of its impact on people whose morale is significantly dented, with a significant stretch of the winter still to go. And with the key government previous promise to keep schools open, you know, torn in shreds, really, because that's simply not going to happen now. And reasonably understandably. So, you know, absent the vaccine, the promise offered by the vaccine, we are really back where we started. And we're not alone in this. Lots of other countries have been through this. I suppose the difference here is that there is this, in Ireland, there is this extreme nervousness and probably justified one about the ability of the health service to cope. You know, if you look at Germany, I would have considered them a reasonable paragon for how to deal with this and get on with the economy and so on. But they've struggled too. But, you know, they're coming off their peak without having, you know, they've had their difficulties in their health service. Things have been full, but they haven't been in panic stations. And that's what we're always afraid of in Ireland.
Is there a further fear at all that figures over the last couple of days show that the proportion of the current cases which are ascribed to the what's called the UK variant, for want of a better word, has risen up to 25%, I think, now they're saying recent testing shows. And when this variant became, when it became clear that was a problem in England in early December, the reason it became apparent was because the quite strict lockdown measures which they had imposed in southern England at that point hadn't worked. So is there a fear perhaps that as this variant becomes prevalent or perhaps dominant, that the kind of lockdowns that worked in the past mightn't work as well?
Yes, that seems to be the thinking. It's adding, as everybody knows, to the R number. It's said to be 70% more transmissible. So it changes the calculus and the kind of suite of measures that might have worked. We talked at the end of last year about, you know, how level three measures in Ireland would keep things on steady state and level four and five would drive down the virus. That has to be reassessed and a new set of measures, envisioned. It tilts the argument. You know, there have been a group of scientists throughout this crisis in Ireland saying that we need to aim for zero COVID, we need to suppress the virus. And it tilts the argument a little bit towards them in terms of making rolling lockdowns all the more likely, because we haven't found a way out of this. Though, to be honest with you, I suppose the success of the incipient success of the vaccines offers one.
Pat, can I ask you about the thinking within government on this? Obviously, it's thinking that's changed pretty dramatically over the past 2 weeks or so, and the government has had to react pretty quickly. Some people think it should have reacted quicker. Some criticism, including in our own pages of the last 2 days or so of government action, and perhaps a sense that there was a bit of panicking going on. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think there was panic in government, and the sense I get from talking to people in and around government in the past week has been just complete fear of what is beginning to happen in, or obviously is well underway now, in hospital accident and emergency units in ICU, and what is to come over the coming weeks. Nobody saw this coming. Not even the gloomiest parts of the most pessimistic wing of NPHET back at the end of November, start of December, when restrictions from the second lockdown were being eased, suggested that we could be looking at a situation where we had several thousand new cases a day. Several hundred, yes, but several thousand is beyond the expectations of anyone, and I think that has hit rolled over government like a tsunami, really. I mean, the political consequences are, of course, you know, less important than the real world consequences for people's health, for their lives. But I think that, such as they are, the consequences for the government depend on two things. One is what happens in the next week or two in the hospitals and in the ICUs. There is a risk that they're completely overwhelmed. My guess perhaps is that the contingency measures that have been were put in place last March and April and are being rapidly revisited might be sufficient to cater for this surge. But I guess we just don't know at this stage. So that in effect is kind of out of the government's hands almost. It's already in train. But the second thing that I think will have a significant effect on the political consequences for the government is in the government's control, and that is the rollout of the vaccine. Now, to some degree, they are constrained by supplies from Europe. But as Paul has written in the paper in recent days, it is probably too early to make a judgment on this, but the beginning of the rollout has not been encouraging. The numbers that are reaching patients or the numbers of vaccines that are being vaccinations that are being performed is really quite low. And just as the government has, I suppose, benefited by comparison with the mismanagement of the pandemic in our nearest neighbour, They will suffer from the comparison of what looks like a pretty prompt rollout of vaccines in the UK.
I'll come to Kevin in a moment, but just back to you, Paul, on that for a moment. Michael McDougall has a opinion column in the Irish Times this morning, and he talks about how, on one level, the implementation of lockdowns is a relatively straightforward hammer, which is a metaphor which is often used for it, for a government to implement. But that something like the rollout of the biggest vaccination program in the history of the state is more complex. It's a greater feat of, I suppose, state engineering. And therefore, there are more pitfalls involved there. I get a sense that you've been careful not to be overcritical because it's such early days at the moment. But there is a general sense of concern out there about the ability of the state to do this as quickly, as effectively as it should be, to save as many lives as it can.
Yeah, perhaps that's based on just some of the early evidence. I mean, even the minister seemed to be a bit unclear at between Christmas and New Year how many doses of the vaccine, the first vaccine he was going to get when we were starting. Yeah, I mean, we do vaccination programs. We do them well. We get high uptake. And even when the uptake drops, as with HPV a few years ago, we get it back up again. We have the staff and the experience and you know, the public buy-in generally. So it isn't rocket science in that way. We are constrained by external factors, one being tied into the EU system, which has been cautious in its authorization of new vaccines and cautious in its negotiating approach with the drug firms, so that we've ended up at the moment, although that's probably going to change now, but with just one vaccine, that you know, one egg in our basket as such, and an expensive one at that, and everybody else is looking for it too. So that's why we've been a bit slow to get. There's nothing you can do about that, really. It does give us time to get things right, I suppose. You know, some scientists say that 90% of the lethality of this disease will be gone by March if we get all the healthcare workers and the care home residents vaccinated. That doesn't mean, you know, there are a lot of uncertainties after that. We don't know if the vaccines will stop people passing on the disease. We don't know the duration of efficacy for the different products. But certainly we will start seeing an improvement, in, you know, regardless of whether we move fast or slow. But I think there's also an economic issue here as well. I think in 12 months' time, I think we will be looking back on this as recent history, but those 12 months can make a big difference to the functioning of the Irish state and whether we can maintain a reasonably good economic record in recent years or whether we go into some sort of trough like we did a decade ago.
Can I ask you in relation to, I mean, there's some reference there to the zero COVID advocates. And I was listening to one of those on RTE at the weekend who was essentially saying that we could have two or perhaps three more of these sorts of lockdowns over the course of 2021. And I know that there's a certain amount of uncertainty about how quickly the vaccine will be rolled out. But most of the figures I've seen indicate that, as you say, by March, maybe April, the most high-risk parts of the population will have been vaccinated, and they account for really the vast majority of fatalities, at least. And so that we can reasonably expect that fatalities will reduce enormously. Now, of course, there are questions about about not letting the disease spread rampantly among the rest of the population. But there are probably a different set of calculations that you might be making about reducing to level two or level one or whatever you want to call it.
Absolutely, yeah. I very well recall one Sunday in April, I think it was, when I received a research paper from an Irish-based scientist in London, and she had modelled that we would be facing repeated waves of this virus. And I chuckled away thinking this was hilarious, but worth it. And we made a front page on a maybe quieter Monday morning thinking that this is never going to happen. And of course, her worst predictions have been borne true. So yes, that is the model that has been shown to be the case. You're right. Once the people who are most at risk from dying from this disease are removed from the equation, then there is a different calculus to be made, one that tilts more towards you know, particularly if we're sure that our health service can cope. And as I said, we have more questions to ask on that than some other countries. But once that happens, then I think you really have to say, okay, are we ready to reopen schools or parts of the economy that have been closed? And I think that will be, there will still be ethical issues out there about the exposure of people who are either known to be vulnerable or don't even know that they are vulnerable to this disease. But, you know, that then perhaps it starts falling into the realm of how we treat a lot of other diseases, you know, whether it be hepatitis or tuberculosis or all the other risks that we face in life. And it becomes a bit more quotidian than this extraordinary event has been. Just to finish, you mentioned that the zero COVID people, and their view is basically that we probably need to lock down until Patrick's Day to get numbers down sufficiently. That's not something that obviously the politicians want to be telling people, but that is, you know, at the end of January, we are going to be facing, or maybe later, we are going to be facing yet another fork in the road when we have to decide what we're going to do, especially if we don't seem to be able to hold this disease in some sort of steady state.
Yeah, I'll come back to Pat in a minute about that question of timeframes. But Kevin, you've been waiting very patiently there. You've done a lot of interesting work about the politics of this in terms of the political support, the views of different parts of the population. And there's been a lot of argy-bargy, I've noticed myself, on social media over the last few days about a lot of hindsight 2020 stuff going on about how correct or wrong the decision to move out of level 5 at the end of November was, now that we know what we know now. And also some suggestions that the government did that without popular support. What do we know, do we know anything about what the view of the public was then and what it is now on how strict restrictions should be?
Yeah, I mean, there's a little bit of a misconception, I think, that'll please probably neither side in this debate as to who was to blame after the fact, obviously, about whether the public wanted, in relation to COVID in October in particular, you know, when decisions were made to close, and then in November when decisions were made to reopen. But it is true that a large majority of 72%, according to the CSO and similar figures in Ireland, thinks, and then also other polling companies have very similar figures, about level 5, that when level 5 was introduced, there was broad support for that when that was in place. It's also true, though, that when the relaxation of restrictions was announced in late November, that was also deemed appropriate. There was actually quite a large support for that as well, particularly indoor dining, you know, when as people, whether they had thought that had gone too far or not far enough, or whether that was about right, you know, those that thought it had not gone far enough, plus those that thought it was about right, again, was around 73%. And it may seem counterintuitive to think, how can the public switch so significantly? But I think a lot of this comes down to a significant section of the public, essentially, that will tend to compliantly follow what it perceives to be the government advice of the day, whatever that advice may be. Now, that's not suggesting they're particularly naive or anything. There's obviously sensible reasons for that as well. You know, there's a sensible proportion of people that might not be confident about their own estimates and might kind of trust, naturally enough, the government or NPHET or some combination of the two in relation to what is the appropriate thing. And, you know, some of this is also why, you know, in the government's own data from Amoroc, you'll see this kind of static figure of a large proportion of people who think whatever the measures are that are appropriate, even as the measures change quite significantly over time. So I think that's it's a very important thing. And you know, we've done a kind of a cluster analysis thing, which is, it's a sort of a technique to try to identify groups of voters in society according to kind of people who have similar responses to one another along the same lines. And these types of people are typically older, typically vote Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael. And, you know, naturally enough, it's, as I said, it's an understandable position, essentially, to trust the institutions. You know, it's something you can often think of also in any political context, in terms of party ID, you know, just thinking as a political scientist as well, which is an idea that you'll follow whatever your party says, because it's a kind of a predictable thing to do. You know, why, you know, in spite of all the hype in relation to Donald Trump, you know, 85% of his voters had voted for Mitt Romney, someone with a completely different worldview. There's a kind of a party idea. I'm not suggesting all these people in Ireland are Republicans or conservative or anything like that in that respect. You know, this is just a feature, I think, of politics where, you know, political issues emerge, but if the government takes a position, lots of people will rightly, to some extent, trust that government's position, I think.
But then in relation to that, the kind of the 70% figure is larger than just older voters or just Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil supporters. Isn't there in relation to this also a kind of an element, to be honest, I'd have a bit of this myself, which is a kind of an Occam's razor answer. I'm not a qualified epidemiologist. I don't have the scientific know-how. At some point, the best thing for me to do in the absence of any clear evidence to the contrary is to go along with the best expert opinion available.
Yeah, absolutely. And when I say that 70%, I'm sort of including that group which, you know, there's a group which I can think of as kind of those that are tired of COVID. I think we're probably all tired of COVID in some respect, but people who kind of want more relaxed restrictions in general, who don't necessarily support the two parties. In fact, a lot of them would support Sinn Féin in particular. But yeah, no, I think it's to some extent quite a reasonable position. I think in relation to that debate of whose fault it was, I think it's a little bit more muddled because at the end of the day, as Paul alluded to, the Christmas episode was probably the bigger thing, really, I think, to some extent. You know, with over 1,000 sort of pre-symptomatic cases, the real decision perhaps was whether or not the government would, you know, inverted commas, cancel Christmas, which is a huge political call. And I think it's something that neither the opposition nor even NPHET to some extent were willing to kind of approach either. So I think it's within that context that was probably the bigger decision to make, whether to, you know, when we knew we were moving to level 5 by, you know, December 22nd, and it would have taken quite a lot of political leadership, which is at the end of the day which drives some of that kind of middle ground, to say to people, right, we're not going to have, you know, three households visiting one another, even when we have all these pre-symptomatic cases. I think that was the big decision to make. Now, obviously, set against that, there's a rising and important concern about mental health. You know, one of the other things the opinion polls show is that, you know, quite a large proportion of the public have observed their mental health deteriorating over the last year. Even 6 months is the question that I put to people, which was, you know, from March almost until November or so. And that was particularly the case among younger people. So there's an understandable, you know, anticipation of Christmas and cancelling Christmas and the impact that might have. Perhaps, though, there was other evidence that might have shown that actually, you know, the notion of cancelling Christmas as opposed to a lockdown might have actually been possible. You know, the polls also show that, you know, when faced with that trade-off, although some might find it surprising, that a slight majority, you know, and this is again the same poll that showed so many people in favour of indoor dining, a slight majority were in favour of restrictions of Christmas over, you know, the idea of a subsequent lockdown in January, as easy as the lockdown in January is easy to do because people are kind of adhering to restrictions, and we can see the R numbers already starting to decline already. But that's the kind of, I think that's an interesting question because it comes back to the politics of to what extent are the politicians on top of what the voters think, and where is that trade-off in terms of to what extent can Micheál Martin or indeed as Leo Varadkar did earlier in March lead the public towards the sensible conclusion. Now, obviously, the government has made significant decisions in the last 24 hours in relation to, you know, travel to the country and schools, which have radically changed things. But I guess the question was for me whether they could have made some of those decisions earlier, which would have been difficult decisions, no doubt. But I think actually they were possible. You know, I think it was possible to do it.
Yeah, I think I think that it is reasonable to ask questions of how quick the government responded to the growth in cases from mid-December on. Now, you know, government was certainly signalling a bringing forward of the restrictions from before Christmas, but I think it's reasonable to ask why that wasn't done, you know, even a week earlier, because we had seen in mid-December, according to the department's own research, the research which signalled, as Kevin said, a couple of weeks earlier, broad agreement with the government's position, which was not just that there should be a lockdown in November, but that the lockdown should end at the start of December. But that research shows what we've seen on a number of occasions since the pandemic started, in this sort of interplay in public opinion between, I know, caution and boldness, or lockdown and loosening, whatever you want to call it, where the numbers of people who believe, if you've tracked the two lines of, you know, caution and boldness, if you like, and they cross one another. And we've seen that. That is to say that, you know, more people start believing that more restrictions are necessary than fewer restrictions are necessary. And that, and that change in public opinion, which had happened in the middle of summer before the second lockdown, which had happened again then just after the second lockdown, when people began to become more optimistic, again the sense that the virus was under control, again those two lines crossed one another in the middle of December. And put that in plain language, it meant that people realised that people realized that the virus was on the march again, probably from what they were seeing in their own daily lives, the extent of socializing and so forth. And it was at that point then, I think, that the government might have acted quicker. But to say that the lockdown should have been continued, as lots of people are suggesting now, seems to me to be the application of hindsight that is kind of not reasonable.
Paul, just looking ahead then, you mentioned, you know, that obviously the recurring fear here is always that the health system is overwhelmed and that people can't receive the treatment that they need. How imminent or real is that danger over the next 2, 3, or 4 weeks? Or can we tell that at all?
Well, by way of perspective, let me say that on this day last year, we set a new record for trolleys of 760 people waiting for admission to hospital, one which was repeated the following day. We were nowhere near that, actually. Obviously, every winter is a crisis in the Irish Health Service. And so this is no different. This is a crisis plus a lockdown to prevent a bigger crisis. My own feeling is Christmas is over. The kind of hibernation period that January is set in anyway, added to the lockdown. I think we'll probably get through it as usual by the skin of our teeth, as is the case most winters. There are some straws in the wind. You know, the number of contacts per case is almost halved. So what I'm hearing from doctors is that they have been coping. When we talk about ICU beds, I think it's only a minority of very seriously ill patients who have need the full panoply of intensive care, and often what's called high dependency. You know, we're talking about the difference between single organ failure and multi organ failure. I know this is getting a bit technical, but nobody wants to be very seriously ill with this disease, but it does have implications for the staff ratios and so on. Obviously, the fact that there's so much virus out there is knocking out a lot of staff, not just through infection, but more pertinently through being having to isolate because they're contacts, and that effect should hopefully start to lift and increase the ability of the health service to cope. And then we will have to sit it out. Then we'll have to make some pretty hard decisions towards the end of the month about what and how to reopen. I do think, based on my reading of the figures, you know, in terms of schools, which is really important, I know it's very important in my house because schools were supposed to be back today and they're not. And I've heard nothing from any of my children's school about Zoom lessons or anything like that so far, which is disappointing. there is a case for perhaps treating primary school children different from secondary because of the lower rates of transmission. It is complicated because it's not just about what happens at school, which is a safer environment, but it's also about mixing on the way to school and after school and things like that. But when things improve, perhaps there might be a graduated reopening rather than let's keep the schools closed for a very long time as we did last spring.
Pat, what are your contacts in government saying about schools? Because obviously, if things go beyond the end of the month, which they're already going to go to the end of the month, if we go into February, you have the appalling vista, I'd imagine, for Norma Foley in particular, of a second year of crisis around the Leaving Cert, for example.
Yeah, Micheál Martin said yesterday that it's the intention that the Leaving Cert go ahead. But of course, it's the intention that it goes ahead until such time as it doesn't go ahead. I think it's a massive blow politically to the government to have to close the schools. And there was significant resistance to it right up until the point of the decision. And partly that's because opening the schools in September in the face of some opposition, let us not forget, and then keeping them open during the second lockdown, I think conveyed the impression to an awful lot of people that the government actually knew what it was doing and was managing proactively the pandemic. Having to close them now, I think, dispels that sort of image quite a lot and conveys perhaps the more accurate picture of a government that is simply reacting to the numbers of the virus that it sees on a daily basis. So I actually think that the closing of the schools, although inevitable at this stage, is politically highly damaging. And I think that there is an awareness of that in government from my conversations with people in and around government. And I think they will want to get them open as soon as possible. But of course, we all know it's a lot easier to close, as last year shows us, it's a lot easier to close them than it is to open them. One thing I will say, though, about it is that I think from not just a political point of view, but from, a health point of view in terms of the mental health of students, and as Paul would be aware, and I am too, of their parents who have went through several months of homeschooling last year and are now faced with this dread prospect once again. I think there's a much greater awareness of those sort of costs to keeping the schools closed, particularly on the most, the most vulnerable students, those with special needs, but also those who don't have the sort of ready access to homeschooling facilities as the most fortunate students might have. And I think there is an acute awareness of that in government. That having been said, the only way the schools would get opened is if the numbers tumble fairly precipitously in over the coming weeks, and just nobody knows if that's going to happen or not.
Yeah, indeed. And the other very important part of this, of course, is the teachers and the teachers' unions themselves, and whether they think that their members can safely return to work, and there's all kinds of questions there. Listen, a last thought to you, Kevin. My reading of your research is that, unlike some other countries, particularly the United States, obviously, the pandemic has not become a point of kind of political polarization, or at least there isn't a political binary out of it in the same way as there has been in some other countries. There's a certain amount, fairly substantial amount of consensus. Is that fair? And if that's the case, is that likely to continue as we drag on in the, as Paul said, a very tired state that we're in with this thing now?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's certainly at the start of the pandemic, we had that kind of rally around the flag effect where lots of governments, not least our own in Fine Gael, actually had this massive increase in support. That actually hasn't subsided that much in most countries. You know, in Germany, the CDU are still up, but where they were in Italy, the Cinque Stelle and the Partito Democratico haven't really changed since their their support levels haven't really changed since March. Obviously, in the US and the UK, it damaged effectively the government's, and I think some of that is a function of at least perception of the competence of the government of managing the situation. It certainly realigned and facilitated the realignment of Irish politics in that Fine Gael versus Sinn Féin dynamic. I don't know if anyone peruses social media, but on any given day, one or the other is regularly trending without any sort of context whatsoever. And that dynamic in Irish politics is emerging. One polling question I've asked recently enough was whether people would prefer one of three options as a kind of forced choice between voting for a party that wouldn't go into coalition with Sinn Féin, wouldn't go into coalition with Fine Gael, or whether they didn't really mind about whether their party went into coalition with either one or the other, just to try to understand the level of polarisation in Ireland in this respect, and to what extent, you know, since the general election and obviously the pandemic, which has accelerated without it being a political issue. I mean, the opposition hasn't really opposed very much of any of the government's decisions, but we've emerged in this kind of polarised environment. But what the data suggested was that there was obviously quite a lot of opposition to Sinn Féin, particularly among older voters. But when you got to the kind of under 35s, there was almost more polarisation there in terms of there was large numbers that opposed coalitions with Fine Gael and equivalently almost as large numbers that opposed coalition with Sinn Féin. But the interesting point was that among that youngest group, there was very little middle ground, really, which was quite interesting, because perhaps that shows maybe where the development of Irish politics is in the future. And maybe that's one of the long-standing impacts of this pandemic. But who knows? You know, Fianna Fáil have improved in their polling position since, particularly since November. And I think some of that is a function of a couple of missteps maybe by Leo Varadkar in that particular period of time and relative competence for Micheál Martin. Whether Micheál Martin will get any sort of rally in this latest wave, I don't know if that's going to happen. But it'll be interesting to see, look, whether Fianna Fáil kind of emerge and kind of can redefine in this kind of hopefully final wave of the pandemic, and whether that will kind of reassert the political system as it was, you know, a year ago, and we might be in a newer political system, I guess.
And that's exactly the kind of stuff which we plan to continue discussing over the course of the year. We'll leave it there, though, for today. Thanks to Kevin, and thanks to Pat and Paul, also to our producer, Declan Conlon. And if you would like to get in touch with us, we're delighted to hear from you. Just mail us at politicspodcast@irishtimes.com. But until the next time, thanks very much indeed for listening.